Chapter 4. For the next couple of days, I back and forthed on whether I wanted to go to Miles's wedding or not. The con column was looking pretty long, because it would be a faff, Oliver would have an unbelievably shitty evening, on account of not knowing anybody, and, oh yes, there was that tiny, insignificant detail that showing up at all would be a tacit admission that I was totes chill with that one time Miles completely fucked me over. But somehow, that didn't stop me secretly wanting to go. Because things were good. I was, not that I'd ever admit it to anybody at crap, actually enjoying my job. My relationship with Oliver was as strong as it had ever been, although it wasn't like 2 years in with Miles, I'd been thinking to myself, wow, this guy's going to hurt me worse than any human being has ever hurt me in my life. And God, what was my brain doing? Why was it comparing the selfish prick I'd dated nearly a decade ago with the objectively better man I was seeing right now? I mean, Oliver was objectively better, wasn't he? Our relationship was objectively better. We were older and more mature and more sensible and... wait. Were we just boring? Safe and predictable and full of table lamps? Of course, given recent events, we were getting to the point of having more lamps than tables, which definitely wasn't boring. After all, if we were still breaking the furniture, we were doing something right. Okay, this was exactly why I needed to go to the wedding. I need to show my ex-boyfriend's fiancé I'd met once, and a bunch of strangers, that I was free and happy and over it, and moving on with my new, infinitely better boyfriend. And if I did that well enough, maybe my own brain would believe me. Until then, though, I needed to get A, a grip, and B, back in the moment. Especially because Oliver and I were going out this evening on a proper, grown-up, we-are-in-a-relationship date. We were doing, and it was kind of hard to say this with a straight face, dinner and a show. He'd booked us a table at this place called Stem and Glory, which was apparently one of the best vegan restaurants in London, and I was slowly coming to the conclusion that the best vegan restaurants in the city really were nicer places to eat than an average restaurant that would just serve me a piece of dead cow. Then, afterwards, well, that had been complicated. Oliver had wanted to see Death of a Salesman at the Young Vic, but I told him that if I was going to a vegan restaurant for him, he had to go to Pretty Woman the Musical for me. And honestly, I was kind of psyched about it. Well, psyched-ish. It had been quite a long day, all told, because the photocopier had jammed, and then Alex had insisted on trying to fix it and got his hand stuck somewhere inside, and Barbara Clench had refused to let me get an engineer to come and extract him, because she was concerned that if he was seen interfering with the machine, it would invalidate the warranty. Not that there was much chance of our keeping the incident secret anyway, since Rhys Jones-Bowen had been live-streaming the whole time and soliciting possible solutions from his ever-growing army of followers, or aristocrats, as they'd apparently taken to calling themselves. Anyway, I was just leaving when my phone rang. It was Bridget's number, but that was the only clue I had that it was actually her, because for a long time she had trouble getting words out, which was the first sign that something was seriously wrong. Because sure, Bridge lived from disaster to disaster, but she dealt with that by loudly declaring how ruined everything was, while at the same time calmly fixing the actual problem. It was a slightly peculiar process, but seemed to work for her. When she got quiet, though, that meant she was genuinely stuck and was falling back on my preferred strategy, pretending the problem didn't exist in the hope that it would go away. Bridge? I asked into the silence. Bridge, what's going on?
It's...
The voice was her, but she sounded choked up.
It's Tom...
Shit. There were two ways this could go, and neither was good. Is he okay?
Probably.
That was her angry voice. So this was a Tom's done something cool, not a something's happened to Tom cool. I wasn't sure which was worse. My phone buzzed and a text came in from Bridget. It was a photograph. A photograph of Tom looking furtive with his arm around a pretty young woman. A pretty young woman who wasn't Bridget. For which there must have been a million reasonable explanations that a person who hadn't spent most of his adult life developing deep-seated trust issues could have articulated. Unfortunately, Bridget had called me. Crap, Bridge, I said finally. The trick here was to walk the line between being supportive and encouraging her to blow up her own wedding. And I could do that. I could do that. I just had to be nice and as non-committal as possible and ignore the part of my brain that was screaming, "She's doomed, and so are you. Meeting Miles was a sign, and everything you think you can count on is wrong." "I'm so sorry. Have you..." What would an emotionally mature and undamaged person do? "Have you talked to him about it?" There was a burbling sound from the other end of the line that eventually resolved into,
"I can't get hold of him."
On its own, that wasn't unusual. Tom's job often required him to go quiet for a couple of days, sometimes longer. But it wasn't exactly reassuring. Or at least, I wasn't reassured, and I didn't think Bridge would be either. I tried to stick with neutral questions. "How did you get the picture?"
"Liz saw them."
If it had been any of Bridge's other friends, it might have been less damning, because a lot of them were like, well, me. The type of people who jumped from fearing the worst to deciding that the worst had definitely happened without even needing a run-up. But Liz was a legit vicar, which meant giving people the benefit of the doubt was basically in her job description. And since she was actually officiating at the wedding, it didn't seem likely she'd be maliciously sabotaging it. "Did she say anything else?"
"Just that they were in a cafe together, and they looked close."
There were still, surely, other ways to interpret an about-to-be-married man with his phone switched off, carrying on in a cafe with a mysterious hot lady who wasn't his fiancée. I just couldn't think of any right at that second. "Do you need me to come over?"
"Don't you..."
Bridge gave a sort of noble hiccup.
"Aren't you going out with Oliver tonight?"
Yes. Yes, I was. And it was going to be super romantic and special and all the things that fancy date nights with your long-term partner were supposed to be. This is more important. And the worst, or from another perspective, the best of it, was that I wasn't lying. Bridge would never have asked me to cancel, but she also didn't have to. She'd been there for me through a metric buttload of crises down the years, through Miles, through all the self-destructive shit I'd pulled after, through nearly getting fired, and through everything with Oliver. So I kind of owed her one. Hell, I owed her 20. And even if I hadn't, I'd still have been there for her, because that's what friends were meant to do. And I'd spent way too long not doing it. "I'll be right round," I told her. She made a sad, appreciative noise, and after I'd tried to reassure her that everything was going to be okay in six different ways, each slightly less plausible than the last, hung up. The next bit was going to be awkward. Well, maybe not that awkward, because Oliver would understand. Even if we did have a table booked and tickets we'd bought months ago. Oh, shit. It was going to be awkward, wasn't it? "And thank you, life, for manoeuvring me into a situation where I'd have to let down either my best friend or my boyfriend." It was like whatever I did, no matter how hard I tried, the universe wanted me to know that on some level, I was a crappy person. On this occasion, my crapness manifested partly in not wanting to tell Oliver to his face, or even to his voice, that I was ditching him to hang out with a sad bride. I was 2/3 of the way through my 4th draft of my first text when I realised that I was living down to the universe's expectations of me, and, more importantly, not living up to Oliver's. Fuck. That was the problem with dating a good person. They got their ethics all over you. So, I gritted my teeth and called Oliver. Lucien? Great. He already sounded concerned, either because of boyfriend telepathy or because I normally only rang if I'd set the kitchen on fire. Is everything okay? Not really, I told him, and then realising that could have meant anything from, I think we should break up, to, my leg's been bitten off by a shark, followed up quickly with, I mean, I'm fine, but Bridget's in a hell of a state, and... Look, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to bail on this evening. For just long enough that I could hear my relationship gurgling down the plug hole, Oliver didn't reply. Then he said, Oh. Oh. Another relationship gurgling pause. Sorry, I know you're Bridget's maid of honour, but I don't often get free evenings, and we've been planning this for a long time. I know, it's just, she's my best friend. And she's my friend too. Oliver sounded unhappy. Worse, he sounded like he was trying hard not to be unhappy, which would only make him unhappier. But you know Bridge, she always has some crisis or other. She thinks Tom's cheating on her, I blurted. Oh, he said again. For someone who talked for a living, Oliver could be very monosyllabic sometimes. Yeah. He was silent a little longer. And does she... is he? I wished I had an answer to that. She's got a picture of him with another woman, and honestly, it doesn't look good. But this is me talking, and I'm not exactly the poster boy for healthy, trust-based relationships. Thank you for that vote of confidence, Lucien. Fuck, no, I didn't mean that. I mean, like, I have, you know, issues because of history shit. Sorry. Yes. I do understand. I just... The breath Oliver took next was so deep, it became almost crackly over the phone line. It doesn't matter. You should go and be with Bridget. I winced. No wonder I hadn't wanted to do this. I will. I'm really sorry. It's fine. He didn't, if I was being completely honest with myself, sound all that fine. I'm sure I can get our tickets moved to another night.
We could go see that grown-up play you wanted to see instead.
Oh, no.
I loved that he was making an effort to be cool with this, even if he wasn't entirely succeeding.
I'm very keen to see a musical based on a popular movie from the 1990s. My only regret is that it's going to have original songs instead of thinly repurposing popular music from the era.
That struck me as a very specific concern, and one that was a lot easier to talk about than me ditching him on our first date in ages to hold someone else's hand through something that was almost certainly a storm in a teacup. Is this because I made you watch Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again?
Actually, I enjoyed that more than I expected to, which I will admit was a low bar.
For some reason, Oliver trying to make me feel better was making me feel significantly worse.
And while I appreciate your willingness to sacrifice yourself on the altar of Arthur Miller, I'd rather rebook our tickets for Pretty Woman. It turns out I am, to my mild surprise, disappointed we aren't seeing it this evening.
Really? I asked. Really, really?
Oh, yes. Big disappointment. Big. Huge.
I see what you did there. It was my sardonic voice. But I had seen what he did there, and that made standing him up even harder. You could take someone else, I offered, trying to get in on the self-sacrifice gig.
Ah, yes, said Oliver,
in a manner that suggested this had been my worst idea since the vegan pie. So my worst idea since very, very recently. I could call up one of my many married friends and say, "Hello, would you like to abandon your spouse for an evening in order to see a moderately well-reviewed musical in place of the man I love? I mean, Ben or Sophie would love a chance to stick the other one with the kids." Perhaps, but the sticky would hate me forever. And the important part of that sentence was the man I love, not my married friends. I wrestled with a weird mix of happy, sad cringe. "I'll make it up to you, I promise." He gave a soft, not entirely sincere laugh. "I shall hold you to that, Lucien. Now go help Bridget. It's absolutely the right thing to do." "And I love you too," I added, slightly too late. "Well recovered." We hung up. Then I grabbed my coat, shouted a quick goodbye to Alex, who was still stuck in the photocopier, and made a dash for the door. Because I was a good friend, and a good maid of honour. Which I suppose meant that the joke was on me, because despite all that, I felt like a prick. Chapter 5. I was just doing an emergency Tesco's run to get sorry or sad food when my phone buzzed again. Thankfully, it wasn't a picture of ambiguous infidelity this time. It was a black and white illustration of a man in a tricorn hat jumping a stiffly drawn horse over a fence. Underneath it, Oliver had sent, "Thinking of you." "Dick Turpin?" I texted back. "Yes. I'm amazed we haven't got around to using him yet, but I checked and we definitely haven't." I paused in front of the freezers with one eye on my phone and one on the ice cream. Choosing the right emotional support ice cream was important, but some questions demanded answers. "What do you mean you checked? Do you keep a list?" "No." It was an unusually short message from Oliver, which suggested he was attempting to use comic timing in text. "It's a database." "You have a dick database? A dictabase?" "Now I'm concerned you think I actually have a database." "I bet you have a database," I typed, relieved things between us seemed to be drifting normalwards. "I bet you have an intern who updates it for you." "I think making an intern update my database of dick pics would constitute a hostile working environment." "Depends how nice the dicks are." "That certainly wouldn't stand up in court." Was it weird that I always heard Oliver's text in Oliver's voice? Or was it weirder that Oliver texted exactly the same way he spoke? Probably for the best. That kind of thing could get you disbarred. "If you think that's true," he sent back, "you know very little about the British legal system." Dashing off some laughing emojis, I turned my attention back to the fridge. "Do you think I should get Haagen-Dazs or Ben & Jerry's?" There was a moment of whatever the text version of radio silence is. "It's situational," came Oliver's typically overthought response. "But in the circumstances, I'd suggest getting both." Between juggling my shopping and wrangling with the self-checkout, I didn't manage to put my reply together until I was on my way out of Tesco's, swinging a bag of high-calorie edibles from one hand and texting clumsily with the other. "Good call. It's clearly a two-tub problem." "I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation." I hoped there would be, for Bridget's sake as well as for Tom's. He'd never given me cheaty vibes, and I didn't want to think I'd been that wrong about him. I mean, sure, he'd dumped me for my best friend, but he'd been extremely open about it. Bridge lived in a tiny one-bedroom flat in Plaistow. She was doing well enough at her job that she could have afforded better, or at least bigger, but she'd been resolutely committed to the idea that she was staying in her starter flat until she got her dream home and her dream life, which in her world would inevitably have come with a dream husband and the dream wedding. The worst thing was, she'd been this close to getting all of it. I buzzed on her buzzer, and she let me up without even checking who I was, which was partly typical poor security on her part, but she did it with a sad edge. She opened the door wearing a dressing gown two sizes too large for her, fuzzy slippers with half the fuzz worn off, and a look of profound melancholy. I got caramel choo-choo, I told her, also one of those needlessly huge bars of dairy milk and also a Toblerone, but I think that might have been panic.
Come in.
She gave me the weakest effort at a smile I'd ever seen from her. In some ways, Bridget's flat was as messy as mine had been. It was just that in her case, it was a mess that said, I love everything so much that I can't possibly bear to be parted from it, because my world is full of beautiful memories, and not, I hate everything, and my pants live on the coffee table now. She sat down on the battered old sofa that she'd been dragging from flat to flat with her since we'd been at university, and wrapped herself in an even more battered purple blanket that she'd been dragging with her even longer. I tucked up next to her. Just to establish some ground rules, I said. Do we hate him and think he's evil, or do we trust him and think it's a misunderstanding? Bridge laugh cried.
I don't know. Either. Both. How could he do this to me?
I thought both would be a bad call, so I picked a lane. And with uncharacteristic even-handedness, I picked the lane marked Benefit of the Doubt. He might not have. Liz might have made a mistake.
Liz is pretty smart. Plus she's a vicar.
I don't think that makes her infallible.
No, but it means I feel bad calling her a liar.
Bridge snapped off a triangle of Toblerone.
This was a good call, thanks. I don't know why we only buy them at Christmas.
I took a nibble of the dairy milk. There was an art to this kind of supportive binge, one I'd learned mostly from being on the other side of it. You needed to share enough that you weren't just watching the other person eat, but not take so much that you actually limited their access to comfort food. I don't think she's lying, just that there's lots of reasons Tom could be talking to a random woman in a cafe.
Name five.
I nearly choked on my chocolate. That's not fair. Five is loads.
Okay.
Bridge pulled the blanket a little tighter around herself.
Name three.
Old school friend. Sister he's never mentioned.
I've met his sister, interrupted Bridge. Also, the woman in the photo was white.
Adopted sister we've never heard of? She gave me a disappointed look.
You're only on the second one and you've already gone to bad sitcom territory.
Hey, that trope has been in some very good sitcoms.
I'd ask you to name three, but that's how we got into this mess in the first place.
Fine. I stared at the Toblerone for inspiration and found none forthcoming. What if he's hiring her to set up a lovely surprise for your wedding, and when he tells you what it is, you'll be so overjoyed that you forget this ever happened? Bridge glanced up suspiciously from the caramel choo-choo.
What sort of surprise?
Maybe he's arranging a flash mob to do All You Need Is Love. For about 18 nanoseconds, Bridge let this idea calm her.
I do love Love Actually.
Hell, maybe he's even arranging for some creeper with a camcorder to take stalkery footage of you all night. The 18 nanoseconds were over.
Or maybe he's cheating on me like Alan Rickman. What if he bought that woman a necklace? What if he got her sex and a necklace? What if...
Whoa. I put my hands up. I know I started this, but we can't just go through every subplot in that entire movie. If we do, you'll wind up being worried that he's going to ditch your wedding to get drunk and watch porn with Bill Nye. Bridge flopped back on the sofa.
Is everything going to be a little bit worse now?
If the Love Actually gambit had been a plan, I'd have felt bad, because it had taken us to a very unhelpful place. As it was, I felt bad because I was shit at this. No, I tried. Tom is not Alan Rickman. You are not Emma Thompson, and that woman definitely isn't... Okay, I admit I don't know who plays the secretary.
Heike Makatsch, said Bridget immediately.
And I briefly wondered if the way to keep her spirits up was giving her plenty of opportunities to correct me on rom-com trivia. How did you know that?
It's my favourite film.
Even though at least half the stories are incredibly problematic?
Yes.
She gave me a defiant look.
Now pass me the other ice cream.
I passed, and for a while we just sat like that, curled up on the sofa, dual-wielding frozen dairy products, and watching romantic movies from the early 2000s. Every half hour or so we paused so Bridge could try unsuccessfully to reach Tom.
How did it wind up like this, Luke?
She asked, as we watched the credits roll on While You Were Sleeping.
I thought we'd finally cracked it. You know, life. I mean, we were both with great guys.
Instead of both trying to get with the same great guy, I added.
Exactly. And now here we are again, eating strawberry cheesecake Haagen-Dazs and watching old Sandra Bullock movies like nothing has changed.
There was a strange back-in-halls feeling to the evening, and that made me uncomfortable on a number of levels. You mean nothing has changed because you're having a relationship crisis and I'm with somebody who seems great but is inevitably going to fuck me over? Because that was how it went back in the day.
No, I mean... Shit, sorry, Luke. I really do believe you and Oliver are endgame.
I believed you and Tom were endgame too. Then again, I dated him first, and my taste in men is legendarily awful, so maybe he is just a cheating, necklace-buying scumbucket you're better off without. Bridge balled up the foil from the Toblerone and threw it at me.
Hey, you're supposed to be making me feel better.
Fuck. I was, wasn't I? And I'd been doing a passable job of it up until then, too. Sorry. I let self-hating Luke take over for a moment there. I'm back now.
It's all right. I'm just... I got used to not feeling this way. And now I'm having to feel this way again, and I'm not enjoying it.
I put down the Ben and Jerry's and turned to give Bridget my best sincere look. Okay. Since we're having a back-to-our-youth moment, I put my hand over my heart. As your token gay friend, it is my duty to say that you are a fierce, sickening, incredible woman, and that when you find a man who deserves you, he'll make you feel like a princess every day of your life in a way that somehow manages to avoid reinforcing problematic gender stereotypes. And if it turns out that Tom isn't that guy, then that's his loss, not yours. And you should have the wedding anyway, just to celebrate how awesome you are. Bridget leaned across the sofa and hugged me. Since she hadn't put down her ice cream, it was a mixed experience that I was pretty sure got Haagen-Dazs in my hair, but it was good to know I'd done friending right.
Thanks, Luke, she said,
and then, in a slightly smaller voice, added,
Would you be okay to stay, if I can't get in touch with Tom?
Of course. Oliver will understand. He wouldn't like understanding, but he'd understand. Swivelling around, she lay down with her head on my lap.
I'm honestly sure you two are going to make it.
Even though I have terrible taste in men.
Because you have terrible taste in men. You spent so long refusing to go out with Oliver that he's bound to be right for you.
I wasn't totally sure that tracked, but it was a comforting thought. Fine, I conceded. But in that case, you have to accept that my letting Tom get away proves he's a good guy too. I paused. Unless he isn't, of course. Bridge managed half a laugh.
We'll see. I don't want to think about it anymore tonight.
So we didn't. We queued up Muriel's wedding into 27 dresses and let ourselves stop thinking about anything at all. In the break between movies, I slipped into the hall to ring Oliver and tell him the situation. I'm really sorry, I said. I don't think I'm going to make it home tonight. Things are looking bad, so I should probably stay with Bridge. Once more, I could hear Oliver breathing in that I will be calm way that I hated. Of course, I... That is, if you think it's... Are you sure you're helping? What do you mean, am I sure I'm helping? This wasn't the tack I'd expected him to take. Just that Well, sometimes it's best to let people stand on their own 2 feet. I got that I'd let him down, and I got that he was trying to be reasonable. But this was becoming the kind of reasonable that was worse than angry. She thinks her fiancé might be cheating on her. This isn't an own feet situation. And you're going to drop everything and run to her every time she and Tom are in trouble? Yes, because she's my best friend, and she's always supported me, and I'll always support her. There's supporting. Oliver's tone was getting more restrained and less warm by the moment. And there's being codependent. It's not codependent to be there for your friends. You just meant that you're cross with me for bailing on you, which is fine. But you're taking it out on Bridge, which is not. And also, you're doing it in a way that makes you sound weirdly like your dad. I do not sound like my father. He's never used the word codependent in his life. He'd think it was psychobabble nonsense. This was beginning to feel nastily like a hole, and I should have stopped digging. You know what I mean? All that let people stand on their own feet, stop mollycoddling stuff is pure David Blackwood. I also never said mollycoddling. It was true, he hadn't, and maybe I was just projecting. After I told the Blackwoods to go fuck themselves 2 years ago, we'd barely spoken. But occasionally Oliver would need to go do a family thing, and then he'd come back and spend a couple of days being distant and irritable before we could get back to normal. All right, perhaps that was unfair, but our mutual friend is really going through something right now, and you know being with her is the right thing to do. I'm sorry I let you down. I'm sorry I spoiled our evening, but I had to make a choice. I'm choosing to be a good friend instead of a good boyfriend. There was a long silence. I could practically hear Oliver's brain clicking at the other end of the line. I'm sorry. You're right. I'm being selfish. You've been very distracted recently, and I've been very busy, and this has all come out of... Go and look after Bridget. I'll be fine. Okay, I said. Because there was kind of nothing else I could say. And because I needed to get back to Bridge. And most of all, because I wanted to believe him. Chapter 6. There had been no word from Tom by the following morning, or indeed from Oliver. But then, I hadn't texted him either. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. It was more that I couldn't tell if we'd had a fight or not, and if we had, whose fault it had been. I mean, I had kind of dropped him on extra special date night. Like a dick. Except I'd only done that because I needed to take care of my friend. Like, definitely not a dick. Fuck. I was in a grey dick area. Still, that was way better than wherever Bridge was, which was a barely slept, woke up crying, increasingly convinced her fiancé was cheating on her area. We both called in sick, because she was in no state to work, and I wasn't going to leave her in no state to work. And then we took a box of Frosties with us to the sitting room and huddled on the sofa together.
I just don't understand, Bridge said, through a mouthful of oversweetened breakfast cereal. The wedding is next week. He can't have just vanished. Vanished with a strange woman. Vanished with a strange woman and thrown his phone away.
And I'm sure he hasn't, I told her, although I wasn't, and hadn't ever been, and was getting less sure by the minute. Something has probably come up at work.
Something that just happens to involve him putting his arms around women who aren't me.
I'd hoped sleeping on it would make things seem better, but it hadn't. It had made them seem a whole lot worse. How do you want to play this? I asked. Because Bridge had made me her maid of honour, which meant it was my job to help her plan her wedding, or to help her burn it down, if that was what she needed. Bridge put down the Frosties and re-huddled into her blanket.
I don't know. I just want to talk to him.
At this point, I couldn't tell if I was being supportive or useless. Honestly, it was a bit of both. We could... Do you want to... Should we tell people? I mean, our friends' people, not like strangers in the street. For a long while, Bridge stared at her phone.
Do you think they could help find him?
I gave a deeply uncertain shrug. The thing about our friendship group, and I very much included myself in this, was that we were always helpful, but rarely useful. It can't hurt.
I suppose it's worth a try.
I didn't send the call out on our usual WhatsApp group, currently going under the situationally unfortunate name of Bye Bye Baby, Baby Bye Bye, because Tom was in it. And however this played out, it was unfair to be having the Tom might be cheating on Bridge conversation in a group chat he was technically part of. It had all the worst elements of talking behind his back and to his face. Instead, I pinged a message around the Bridges Bitches, in the reclaim sense, list. Minor wedding emergency, I texted. Tom seems to have vanished. Help, please. A few moments later, Bridge followed up with,
And he is seeing another woman and I am sad.
From there, the conversation got quite complex, in the way that multi-person text chains always did. Priya got in first with a,
Luke, is this legit?
And James Royce crossed that with an,
Oh, what a prize bastard, assuming this isn't all a tremendous misunderstanding.
Then Liz came back, probably replying to Priya with,
It might be legit. I saw him with somebody and it looked suspicious.
Which she followed up with,
But I don't know anything for sure.
But not before Bernadette had stepped in with,
Whatever you need, darling, we're here for you.
And Priya had shot a,
Not sure that's helpful.
Probably replying to James Royce, to which he had replied with,
Well, excuse me for caring.
I'm sure while the other James Royce had followed up with, I think we can locate him if we work systematically from his last known location. All of which Bridget capped off with a,
You're so lovely, but I don't know what to do.
Neither did anyone else. So we called an emergency in-person meeting for those who could make it, with those who couldn't keeping up as best they could via text. By noon, Bridge's tiny flat was packed out with me, Liz, Priya and James Royce, who'd spent 10 minutes manoeuvring an incredibly complicated stroller up a flight of stairs, and then another 10 minutes painstakingly de-strollering baby Jay and strapping him to his chest.
This is going to involve you lot needing my truck again, isn't it?
Said Priya, helping herself to what was left of the Toblerone. Liz, a small blonde woman, who was currently not wearing a dog collar, presumably because she was off duty, leaned back against the wall.
I don't think driving around London without a plan is necessarily going to be the most useful thing to do.
Do you think we should just leave it to God?
Asked Priya.
In my experience,
Liz replied,
God really hates being taken for granted.
James Royce was gently swaying for what I presumed were baby-related reasons.
Come on, baby Jay. We have to help Auntie Bridget.
Priya watched this little routine with visible incredulity.
He can't speak or walk. What help is he going to be?
He's providing moral support,
put in Bridge loyally,
by being adorable.
What's that, baby Jay?
James Royce made a theatrical listening gesture.
He's wondering, Bridget darling, if you've spoken to Tom's friends. One of them is bound to have seen him.
I think it said everything about Bridge that, even in the middle of a personal crisis, she didn't want baby Jay to feel left out of the conversation.
Well, that's a good idea, baby Jay. But I don't quite know what I'd say to them. I can't just ring them up and go, Can you tell me where Tom is? I think he's cheating on me.
How about, suggested Priya, Can you tell me where Tom is? I'm his fucking fiancé.
Maybe just a scooch.
James Royce held his thumb and forefinger together in the universal gesture for tiny.
Less sweary than that. Also not in front of the baby.
Priya gave him a cold look.
He's a fucking baby, James. He's not going to be offended.
Yes, but if it's all the same to you, I don't want my beautiful son's first words to be...
He put his hands gently over baby Jay's ears.
Go fuck yourself.
Be honest,
Priya told him.
It's more interesting than Dada.
You know,
once he'd gone full baby, it was hard to recalibrate James Royce-Royce.
I think he almost said Dada the other day. Well, it was more sort of a blur, but he's getting there.
Mercifully, my phone buzzed with an update from James Royce-Royce. If Liz saw him in Harrow, the woman probably lives locally. Followed by, that means your best chance of catching them would be around lunchtime or rush hour in that area. Then, if you want a more solid plan, I'll need more information. I looked up.
James suggests we check out Harrow around lunchtime, which is kind of now.
Bridget winced.
But what if I find something I don't want to find?
Then you'll have all your friends around you, I said, hoping I sounded reassuring, as opposed to platitude-y.
Well, a lot of your friends.
At that moment, the intercom went off, and another of the bridesmaids stumbled up. Her name was Melanie, and she'd been working with Bridge for years.
Sorry I'm late,
she said, dropping her handbag onto the floor.
Couldn't get away from work. Huge crisis. We're just about to launch an adorable children's book by a very promising new writer about an adventurous puppy who loses his favourite bone. But somebody on the art team has only this second realised that in the final illustration of the book, where the puppy has recovered his bone and it's framed very nicely against the sunset so it's sort of silhouetted. It looks like he's got an enormous erection,
asked Priya.
How did you guess? Sixth sense.
Melanie crossed the living room and gave Bridge a lingering hug.
I'm so sorry, babe,
she said.
We'll get this sorted out, you'll see.
I think...
Bridge relaxed into the hug.
I think we have to sort it out by going to Harrow.
Priya gave a long-suffering sigh.
Fine, get in my truck. Someday one of you bastards is going to have to buy a car.
We all dashed outside to the truck and piled in like clowns in reverse, only to immediately have to pile out again because James Royce-Royce needed to fit a car seat, or at least transform his stroller into a car seat, because obviously the James Royce-Royces hadn't just bought a stroller. They'd bought a multifunctional infant transportation device that looked like a spaceship. It was a weird folding contraption with wheels and a pod, and a kind of padded area that you could tuck a baby into like Superman being blasted off from Krypton. There was a lot of clunking, and a lot of moving parts that didn't seem to be moving quite right, and a loud yelp as James Royce-Royce closed his finger in something that really wasn't designed to have fingers closed in it.
Perhaps, Priya suggested, it'd be easier if you didn't have a baby strapped to your chest.
No,
James Royce-Royce flapped his injured hand.
No, I can do this. It's just we've never used the car seat function, because we're normally walking or taking the tube.
Bridge came forward, helpfully slash hurryingly.
Let me take him.
With the kind of reluctance you only see amongst new parents and people struggling to kick serious addictions, James Royce-Royce unbuckled baby Jay from his chest and handed him over to Bridge.
Support the head! Support the head!
Oh, come on. Even I know that, I said, and I'm the last person you should ever trust with a baby. Bridge was already bouncing baby Jay in that instinctively calming way that some people have, and I definitely didn't.
But Luke, you and Oliver would make such sweet parents.
Would we? He works all the time, and I've never had a goldfish last more than 2 days.
Babies aren't goldfish,
insisted Bridge. I just know I'd... I don't know. Forget to feed it, or leave it on the bus or something. James Royce-Royce looked up from the impossibly complex mechanism from which a car seat was meant to emerge.
That's hard to do.
They make quite a lot of noise.
Something clicked, and a pair of wheels popped down.
Oh, that wasn't supposed to happen. James usually does this. Shift over.
Priya elbowed James Rolls-Royce out the way, pushed down on a button, yanked on a lever, and collapsed the shuttle racer pod machine into a little tilted basket that looked unmistakably car-seaty.
How do you even survive?
James Rolls-Royce contrived to look both huffy and smug.
I have a very helpful husband.
Baby Jay was transferred to the seat, and the seat was transferred to the truck, where it was strapped in securely by people who knew what they were doing. Then we piled in again, and were just about to get underway, like we were in a disappointingly middle-aged road movie, when Bridge burst into tears. And I abruptly discovered it was really hard to comfort somebody when they were sitting behind you in a truck.
Bridge.
Melanie reached over to make the most reassuring physical contact she could make, given the whole truck situation.
Babe, it'll be okay. We'll sort this out.
Bridge sobbed.
I know. I mean, I don't know. It's just the last time I was jammed in a truck doing something silly, we were taking Luke to Durham because he was in love with Oliver, and Tom was with me and everything seemed so wonderful.
That was not wonderful.
Priya and I chorused. Because my relationship had fallen apart, I went on.
And,
Priya pushed in,
I had to drive you bunch of ungrateful shits the whole length of the country.
And Oliver wasn't even there.
And none of you chipped in for petrol.
And then you dumped me on his doorstep in the middle of the night.
Even though you always say you're going to.
At which point Baby Jay started crying, which meant James Rolls-Royce had to unstrap him and do parental things to calm him down. And we were still outside Bridge's flat.
Sugar plums, said James Rolls-Royce. I love you, but if you keep shouting, you'll upset Baby Jay. And if you upset Baby Jay, he'll cry all afternoon.
I'm sorry, Baby Jay.
Bridge half turned, in an attempt to join in the baby soothing.
It's just we were so young and hopeful then.
It was 2 years ago, said Priya. And I wasn't hopeful. I was pissed off.
I've never been hopeful, I added.
Well, I was so young and hopeful.
Weirdly, Bridge seemed to have stopped crying. Maybe because it was quite hard to cry and bicker at the same time. Liz leaned forward from the very back seat.
How about we get on the road? It might help you feel better, and your youth and hope might come flooding back to you.
Hang on.
James Rolls-Royce started bundling and strapping.
Got to get Baby Jay settled again.
I thunked my head gently against the dashboard. We are kind of on a clock here, James.
Fine. I'll just leave my child untethered so he flies through the windscreen the first time we brake suddenly.
I think it's more, I tried, that emergency marriage rescue and baby aren't completely compatible. I'd mostly meant that we should prioritise helping Bridge, because she was the one having a crisis. But now everyone was staring at me like I'd taken the last after 8 mint without even apologising.
Luke,
said Bridget,
definitely not crying now.
That's an awful thing to say.
It's your fiancé we're looking for, I pointed out.
But not without Baby Jay.
Bridget sat back with her arms folded.
He's part of the group now.
I just thought it would be more efficient if we... James Rolls-Royce glared at me.
If we what? Left my child alone in an empty flat with a kitchen knife and a box of matches? Or am I not welcome amongst you now that I'm a father?
Of course you're welcome, James, I tried. I just... It's only... The truck lurched into gear and Priya eased us out into the road.
Drop it, Luke. You sound like a prick.
I dropped it. Because if Priya was telling you that you sounded like a prick, it meant you'd gone way over the prick line. The magic of everyone being slightly angry at me got us back into an old groove, as we bombed, well, not quite bombed, more travelled at a responsible child-transporting speed, along the North Circular. And while I freely admitted that it had been insensitive of me to suggest that having a child made James Royce-Royce a bigger liability friend-wise than, say, me, there's no getting away from the fact that if you'd rated our emergency marriage rescuing out of 10, we were pulling somewhere between a 4 and a 2. I mean, Bridge had stopped crying, so we probably got a point for that. And if there were points for effort, we got at least one of those. But in terms of what we were actually achieving, we sort of weren't. We arrived in Harrow about an hour after we needed to, which meant that even if Tom and his mystery woman had been out getting lunch, they'd have been able to eat, have coffee, tip the waiter, and slink back to their love nest before we'd even parked. This left us sitting outside a random cafe, with Bridge once again on the verge of tears, not really sure what to do next. "What should we do next?" I asked, hoping to keep the action ball rolling so no one had to have emotions. Bridge threw her hands in the air.
"I accept that love is for everyone else in the universe except me, so I'm going to die alone, surrounded by cats, even though I don't like cats, and I'll only be found when the juices from my lonely, suppurating corpse leak through onto the married couple below me, while they're having a beautiful Sunday dinner with their children."
So score 0 for the action ball, then.
"That will never happen," said Priya. "Your cats will eat you way before you start leaking."
"I'm so sorry."
That was Liz, who had been sinking farther and farther in the back seat.
"I feel this is all my fault."
"It's not your fault."
Bridge twisted round.
"You're not the one cheating on me."
"We don't know he's cheating on you. I should never have sent the picture. Jesus would not have sent the picture."
Melanie glanced up from Baby Jay's toes, which she'd been leaning over to this little piggy.
"St. Paul might have. I bet he'd have sent it straight to the Ephesians."
"That doesn't help," cried Liz. "I'm a vicar. I'm not supposed to gossip. It's just you're my friend and I'm bad at keeping secrets."
Blowing her nose into a tissue, Bridge made a visible effort to pull herself together.
"You did the right thing. I don't want to marry a man I can't trust."
"All is not lost, my little shoe bun."
That was James Royce-Royce, and for a moment it was genuinely unclear whether he was talking to Bridge or the baby.
"My marvellous husband has just texted us a set of instructions. It's a long shot, but apparently if we spiral outwards, then we maximise our chances of seeing Tom, if he's here."
"And if he's not here?" I asked. James Royce-Royce looked apologetic.
"Then we'll have had a rather long afternoon in a rather hot van."
"Truck," corrected Priya. But she followed James Royce-Royce's instructions anyway, taking us on a spiralling path out to the edge of Harrow, then back in again, then back out, then back in. Then we stopped at a pub, so that James could change Baby Jay and the rest of us could get something to drink, before we got back in the truck and went back to spiralling. The thing about spending hour after hour trapped in a metal box with 6 other people, one of them a baby, was that it made you acutely aware of all the times in your life when you'd been doing literally anything else. Like, for example, not quite arguing with the man you'd somehow managed to stay in love with for the last 2 years, and who, miraculously, had somehow managed to stay in love with you. Suddenly, it didn't seem all that important anymore whose turn it was to text.
"I miss you," I sent.
I didn't get anything back, which I knew rationally meant Oliver was in court, but which I felt emotionally meant I'd destroyed my relationship by being insufficiently committed to pretty woman.
"This is hopeless," said Bridge, for the 9th time.
"There's no such thing as hopeless," said James Royce-Royce,
also for the 9th time. Bridge pressed her nose tragically against the window as she scanned a gaggle of passing Harrovians.
"There is such a thing as hopeless. It is this thing. By which I mean what we're doing right now. And also me. Because I'm doomed..." "Oh my God. It's him."
"What?" I jerked alert. "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
Bridge was already unbuckling her seatbelt.
He went into that Tesco Express, the bastard.
Priya obligingly stopped dead, and absolutely not suspiciously, in front of the Tesco Express, and Bridge dove out of the passenger side door. I dove after her, and Mel dove after me. Liz stayed behind with James Rolls-Royce, because they were all sitting together, and diving over a finally sleeping baby Jay seemed like an exceptionally bad idea. We approached the doors of the unsuspecting late-night reduced-offering supermarket, like we were a crack squad of secret agents. Okay, possibly more like we were a crap squad of secret agents, with Bridge yelling at us to cover the doors, and Mel pressing herself against the wall, and, I swear, coming this close to holding her hands like a gun, while I, in a fit of either enthusiasm or paranoia, tried to conceal myself behind a sign advertising massive savings on frozen pizzas. As inconspicuously as, well, as three people who didn't know much about being sneaky, trying to sneak into a public building with massive windows, we dashed inside. Bridge grabbed a copy of one of those magazines with stories like, "My husband murdered my dog, but then he left me for my sister," from an end display, and held it over her face.
"What are you doing?"
I asked, in the quietest voice I could manage, while still making myself heard past the couple buying Diet Coke next to me. She peered around the corner of the magazine.
"Well, I don't want to be recognised."
"You're Tom's fiancé, Bridge. I'm pretty sure he knows what you look like."
"Watch out."
Mel ducked behind a precariously balanced pile of 4-quid tubs of Cadbury roses.
"Somebody's coming."
The somebody turned out to be a man buying one bottle of milk, three teenagers buying nothing, and somebody whose evening plans I didn't want to speculate about, who was carrying a basket of scouring pads, cling film, and chocolate.
"There,"
Bridge pointed. And she was, in her defence, completely right. It was Tom, looking extremely calm and inconspicuous, swiping a few essential items through the self-checkout. The three of us moved into flanking positions, but since he was a professional spy, and we weren't, by the time we'd got into our flanking positions, he'd already vanished again. We pursued him into the street, where Bridge spotted him again, walking up College Road past the Costa Coffee. We almost managed to kid ourselves he hadn't seen us, on account of our amazingly effective spying techniques. But then he turned sharply into Harrow-on-the-Hill station, with the air of someone who knew exactly how to find a crowd when he had to.
"He's escaping," cried Bridge. "My fiancé's escaping."
She broke into a run, shedding a shoe as she went. I retrieved her shoe and followed. Melanie followed me. And then, annihilating the last remnants of our subtlety, Priya's truck pulled over and began curb-crawling along beside us.
"What are you doing?"
I demanded, only mildly hysterically, as Priya rolled down the window.
"What do you mean, what am I doing? We're following Tom."
"Yeah, but..."
I was rapidly running out of breath.
"Discreetly?"
"Mate, Bridge is pelting through London with one shoe on, and I'm driving a giant black truck. Discreet was never an option."
"Okay, but we still need to get him."
Priya kept driving.
"Fine, I'll just ditch my truck here in this pedestrian crossing."
The door opened, and Liz stumbled out, realising slightly too late that slow for a motorised vehicle was unreasonably fast for a human being.
"Come on!"
She made a beckoning noise to James Rolls-Royce, who was unbuckling Baby Jay's car seat.
"Be very careful,"
he admonished us as he scooted across the truck and passed Baby Jay to Mel, who had joined us in the walk slowly next to a truckathon.
"James would have kittens if he knew I'd passed our little boy out of a moving vehicle."
After Baby Jay was safely transferred, and then, once James Rolls-Royce was on the pavement, safely transferred back, we dashed up the station steps to follow Bridge. Or at least, Mel and I dashed. James Rolls-Royce followed as quickly as he could, given his embabyment, and Liz kept a vicarly pace beside him. Inside, we'd just hit rush hour crowds, and I could barely tell where one face began and another ended. But then, I wasn't Bridge, and hadn't developed her highly attuned Tom senses. She saw him swiping his way through a ticket barrier and dashed after him, scrambling over the gates rather than stopping to find her card, and drawing the attention of a Transport for London guard, who immediately set off after her. Which left me with two choices. Either hang back with an air of supportive dignity, or kick off a ludicrous Benny Hill chase through a crowded tube station. Benny won. Tom was just ducking behind a pillar, talking urgently into his phone, while Bridge, minus both shoes now, was sprinting to catch up with him, and the guard was sprinting to catch up with her, and the rest of us were... Well, honestly, most of us weren't in the mood to sprint, but we were at least jogging lightly to keep pace.
Tom,
said Bridge.
Bridge,
said Tom.
Gotcha,
said the Transport for London guard. Bridget turned around.
You haven't got me. I haven't done anything.
You jumped the barrier, miss.
She gave him a defiant look.
Yes, but I'm not getting on the train.
That doesn't make a difference.
Maybe having a barrister boyfriend had gone to my head.
I think it does, I panted. The crime is fare dodging, but if you don't go anywhere, there's no fare to dodge.
This did not endear me to the Transport for London guard.
Who works here, me or you?
By now, Bridge's army of wedding guests had arrived and surrounded Tom, wearing expressions of varying betrayal and exhaustion. Except for baby Jay, who was, you know, a baby. Which meant he looked like all babies always look, grumpy and a bit squashed. Apparently resigned to being caught, Tom put his phone down and said,
Sorry, she's my fiancé.
Oh, am I?
Asked Bridget. Which, if he'd needed one, was Tom's big clue that maybe not everything was in a perfect state of totally fineness.
Then as you can see, he continued, we've got a lot to talk about. So would it be okay if we just left and pretended none of this ever happened?
The guard looked uncertain. Then again, he'd been looking uncertain since we showed up.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can do that. I think I'm supposed to issue an on-the-spot fine.
I am really sorry, offered Bridge, and I really wouldn't have jumped the barrier, except it was a romantic emergency.
Wait, what romantic emergency?
Tom's unflappable demeanour flapped very slightly.
Yeah, what romantic emergency?
Asked the Transport for London guard, suddenly getting interested. Bridge adopted a posture of supreme indignance.
We're getting married in a week, and he's running around with other women.
I am bloody not, protested Tom.
I have proof,
Bridge told the Transport for London guard. The Transport for London guard gave Tom a disappointed look.
May, if you're running around on your bird, be a man and admit it. I'm not, protested Tom again.
Look at this.
Bridge brandished her phone in Transport for London guy's face.
What's that, if it's not running around on his bird?
The guard assessed the evidence dispassionately.
I agree it don't look great, but there could be an explanation.
I've been trying to get him to explain himself for days,
Bridge wailed.
He ghosted me.
Tom's face had gone very, very impassive.
It was work, Bridge. You know, work. What?
The Transport for London guy visibly scoffed.
Are you some kind of spy or something?
Bridge gave the fakest laugh I have ever heard.
No, of course not.
Her voice had lifted by at least an octave.
He's a...
She paused, way longer than any woman should have had to before saying what her fiancé did for a living.
Fireman!
There was a long silence.
Oh, crap!
The Transport for London guard's eyes had gone very wide.
Is this an MI5 thing? Is that woman some kind of secret agent? Yes, said Tom.
Without missing a beat.
She's a defector from a foreign power, and it's vitally important that my fiancée, he gave the word a verbal air quote, and I be able to discuss the rest of this in private.
Transport for London guy nodded and backed right the fuck off.
Of course, won't say a thing. You can count on me, agent.
The moment he was gone, Bridge rounded on Tom, brandishing her phone in his face.
Look, I know she's not really a spy, so who is she? What were you doing? And why are you leaving me for somebody from Harrow?
Tom looked more flustered than I'd ever seen him, which, to his credit, was a lot less flustered than I was in most situations.
I told you, it's work, and she's not from Harrow. That's why we're here.
That,
Bridge said sharply,
makes no sense.
His flusterance intensifying, Tom glanced around the increasingly crowded platform.
Can we go somewhere else?
No.
Bridge, still brandishing, was now also bristling.
I have been trying to call you since yesterday, Tom. Since yesterday. Where have you been?
Tom took a deep breath and leaned in very closely. The rest of Bridge's bitches, used in the reclaimed sense, gathered in.
I have been, he whispered, in a safe house with an informant.
Bridge debristled, very slightly.
Oh.
Now maybe, suggested Tom, we can finish this conversation somewhere that isn't incredibly public.
Trying not to catch the eye of the Transport for London guard on the way out, we all trooped back to the truck and squeezed in.
Found him then,
observed Priya.
Yes.
Bridge was sitting on Tom's lap in the front seat and still not looking totally mollified.
And he's going to explain everything, aren't you?
Tom surveyed the assembled band of demi-strangers.
You realise this is the opposite of operational security?
Just tell me.
Bridge could be very firm when she wanted to be.
The woman in the photograph is married to a major drug smuggler we're investigating. I was moving her into a safe house. We now have to move her to a different safe house, and I'm going to take myself off the case, because somehow you got a picture of us together.
Sorry, said Liz. That was me. The Lord works in mysterious ways and all that.
Behind his eyes, I could see Tom doing some very painful calculations.
And you sent it to Bridge?
And I sent it to Luke,
Bridge added. And, I finished, I sent it to sort of the entire WhatsApp group. Tom thunked his head against Bridge's shoulder.
Everybody delete the picture. It's important. Sorry, Bridge. I should have taken this week off.
She kissed him on the forehead.
It's okay. I knew you were in intelligence. I just didn't know you were James Bond.
You didn't?
Tom risked a smile.
I thought that was why you wanted to marry me.
James Rolls-Royce leaned between the seats.
Oh, that would be a very bad call. James Bond only got married once, and she was dead by the end of the film.
James, said Tom, stop helping.
And?
Bridge seemed to be having a lot of feelings.
And she really was an informant, not like an international sex assassin.
She's an informant, Bridge. There are no international sex assassins. International assassins are just ordinary-looking blokes who stab you with an umbrella or slip you an exploding cigar.
And you haven't bought her a necklace?
It took me a moment to remember what she meant by that, but Tom got there immediately.
I haven't even bought her a Joni Mitchell CD.
And we're still getting married?
Tom gazed up at her with a loving, exasperated expression that Oliver sometimes got when he was looking at me.
I fucking hope so. Otherwise, you just compromised a major drug bust over nothing.
They kissed. And they kept kissing for long enough that we all had to suddenly get very interested in our phones. Which was convenient, because mine chose that exact moment to ring. And thank God, it was Oliver.
Lucien, he said, I got your text, and I just wanted to call to make sure you were okay. I would have texted back, but I was in court.
I definitely knew that, I told him, and wasn't in any way worried you were going to dump me. He gave an embarrassed little cough.
I've been behaving badly because I miss you and want to spend time with you. Dumping you in retribution would be extremely counterproductive.
Lovingly logical Oliver was one of my top five favourite Olivers. I miss you too. But we found Tom. It turned out he wasn't cheating on Bridge, and we actually caused a minor national security incident.
That does sound on brand for you.
Minor national security incident is the name of my sex tape.
Well, that's ruined any possible segue I could have come up with. But when are you coming home?
Pretty much now, unless... My phone screen flashed ominously. Shit, the venue's calling. I have to take this. And so I hung up on the boyfriend I was just patching things up with to do a bit more wedding admin. 5 minutes later, I realised I was going to have to do a lot more wedding admin. Guys? I did my best to attract Bridget's attention.
Yes, Luke?
She was all smiles again.
And thanks for being there for me. You're the best.
Yeah, about that, you know the church? Bridget's face fell.
The church where I'm getting married?
That would be the one. That was their vicar on the phone, and it's... Well, it might have... ever so slightly... Well, it might have burned down?